11. Second Coming. January 2016 to January 2017. After three arrests, two escapes, and more near misses than it cared to count, the United States government had finally had enough. Officials at the highest levels in Washington had come to a decision. Now that Guzman was back in custody, they wanted him on American soil. At least in theory, they had a way of getting him there. Guzman, by then, had been named in seven indictments in seven different judicial districts, and all of them were solid cases ready to take to court. In El Paso, prosecutors had gathered evidence that he was involved in unspeakable violence on the border. In Chicago, the Flores brothers and Vicente Zambada, backed up by the Crackberry wire, were prepared to take the stand. The trove of intercepts that Marston, Patash, and Christian Rodriguez had collected had led to charges in Manhattan. Equally damning messages obtained in Nogales had been used to bolster pre-existing complaints in Brooklyn and Miami. Even the little prosecutor's office in Concord, New Hampshire, had a case against the kingpin on its books. First, however, someone had to get him out of Mexico, and that wasn't going to be easy. Extraditing criminals from the country was a tortuous and time-consuming process. Under Mexican law, defendants were allowed to file an almost endless series of amparos, or injunctions, submitting one in the capital and then, if it failed, in Chihuahua or Sonora, on and on, like a game of legal whack-a-mole. The one restraining factor in the process was how much money and how many lawyers a defendant had, and Guzman had plenty of both. The politics of the situation weren't much better. There were, of course, substantial benefits to sending Guzman north across the border. In a single stroke, the Mexican government could wash its hands of a man who had chastened and embarrassed it for nearly 30 years. But the downsides to extradition were potentially catastrophic. No one knew what Guzman, who was facing life in prison, might say to his American interrogators. If he chose to open up as part of a plea agreement or cooperation deal, his revelations about official corruption and complicity in the drug trade could easily have calamitous effects. In the U.S. Embassy, a small team of officials led by the ambassador, Roberta Jacobson, was hurrying to get the process started. There were already concerns that Guzman would attempt a third escape. The diplomats had been quietly chagrined when, after his recapture in Los Mochis, the kingpin was returned to Altiplano. The Mexican Interior Ministry, in full face-saving mode, had taken several steps to beef up security at the prison, increasing the number of its cameras, installing steel bars in the floors to protect against tunnels, and posting tanks and troops outside the walls. Guzman's guards had relieved him of the privilege of conjugal visits and had started to wake him at all hours of the night for spot inspections. But no one, or certainly no one at the embassy, had any real faith in the system. There was a very strong assumption that he was planning an escape, Ambassador Jacobson said, and that was discussed with the Mexicans. We had to assume that none of the facilities he might be sent to were foolproof in their ability to hold him. Jacobson and her colleagues felt like they were fighting both the clock and the leisurely Mexican courts. Unless we got things moving, she said, we feared he might get out again. At least Los Pinos, the Mexican White House, was sending the proper signals. A few weeks after the capture in Los Mochis, President Peña Nieto, traveling in Davos, announced that he was planning to fast-track extradition. It was a promising turnaround from 2 years earlier, when Mexican officials had coyly rejected an American request. Following the kingpin's last arrest in Mazatlan, Jesus Murillo, the attorney general, had said he would consider extradition at the right time. That, his advisors later noted, would be in a few hundred years, only after Guzman had been sent to jail for the 8 separate Mexican cases he was facing. With momentum moving against them, the Kingpin's lawyers opened a new front in the battle. After filing their first round of injunctions, they launched an all-out publicity campaign. Throughout the winter of 2016, they gave interviews to anyone who would listen, complaining that the staff at Altiplano was violating Guzman's human rights. It was bad enough, they said, that the prisoner had been turned into a zombie after weeks of being woken by his guards. But it was even worse that they themselves were allowed to see their client only once a week and for little more than a half hour at a time. At a press conference outside Altiplano's gates, one of the lawyers wore a sweatshirt with Guzman's photo on the front and an exclamatory slogan shouting, "Extradition never." The lawyer announced that he was going on a hunger strike and begged his fellow Mexicans to join him. Placing extra pressure on the government, the Kingpin's lead attorney, José Refugio Rodríguez, cleverly adopted the president's own position. He signaled that his client would welcome extradition, even plead guilty in the United States, under one suspicious condition. Refugio demanded that in exchange for Guzman's cooperation, American officials had to agree not to send him to a maximum security prison. "Physically, he's in very bad shape," Refugio said. "If they don't let him sleep, he'll die." Adding a personal touch to all of this was Emma Coronel. In her 9 years of marriage to the Kingpin, Emma had maintained an aristocratic distance from the public, supporting her husband and burnishing her own myth through the mysteries of a calculated silence. But starting in February, 1 month after Guzman's arrest, she began to dangle herself in a series of stage-managed, on-the-record interviews. The first stop on her tour was Telemundo, the Spanish-language broadcasting giant, which heavily promoted her Sunday evening primetime appearance as the first-ever conversation with El Chapo's queen. Dressed demurely in a sleeveless blouse with a white bow at her throat, Emma fed the network a string of casual lies. She told her interviewer that, at least as far as she knew, her drug lord husband had never trafficked drugs. Nor, she insisted, had he had ever said a bad word or gotten upset at anyone. In all of this, Emma drew a sharp distinction with Guzman's jailers who, she complained without a trace of irony, were watching him all day long, stripping him of privacy, even in the bathroom of his cell. Over the next few weeks, she repeated this performance two more times, first for Univision, Telemundo's chief competitor, and then for the Los Angeles Times. That same month, she paid a quiet visit to Damaso López. When the chief of staff received her, in Culiacán, it seems, Emma brought regards from her husband and told Damaso a secret she had not revealed to her television audience. Guzman was already planning his third escape. "It was a huge effort," Emma said. And once again, she asked for Damaso's help. Loyal to a fault, Damaso agreed to do what he could, though at a follow-up meeting, he confessed to Emma that the company's operations budget was running somewhat low. Still in place as the Kingpin's regent, Damaso would have surely been aware of the troublesome developments that had slowly been eroding the cartel's profits. In 2012, the same year Guzman was raided in Los Cabos, no less than three of his Colombian suppliers had been taken into custody, putting downward pressure on the company's cocaine division. Much more recently, its marijuana business had been trending lower too, in part because of the move toward legalization in the state of California. Just before his last arrest, the Kingpin had managed to recoup some of his losses by finding new sources of cocaine and astutely investing in experimental products like synthetic heroin. But with an expensive new escape plot in the offing, at least some part of Damaso's thoughts must have been focused on the effects it would have on the company's bottom line. Emma dismissed these worries out of hand. Meeting Damaso for a third time, she arrived with money, or rather with the promise of money, $100,000 that had, she said, been earmarked for the purchase of another piece of land near Altiplano. As Tommaso realized, the new escape plan wasn't new at all. It was merely a reprisal of the old plan. Whatever it was, it soon hit a wall. In early May, after only 4 months at Altiplano, Guzman was rousted from his cell one night and flown without warning to Ciudad Juarez, where he was imprisoned in a new facility, the shabby, gang-infested Severoso No. 9. Not long after he arrived, his lawyers brought him more bad news. Two judges had just denied their package of injunctions and approved his extradition to either San Diego or El Paso. The governments on both sides of the border seemed to be serious this time. The American requests for extradition had been sent to Mexico City in two separate dossiers. Both were nearly 5 inches thick. Trying desperately to keep their plan on track, Emma reached out to Tommaso one last time. She reassured him that Guzman was working day and night to get out of Juarez and back to Altiplano, noting that her husband had already sent a generous gift to an official who could make that happen, one of the top men in the Mexican prison system. When Tommaso asked her how much had been spent on the gift, he could not have been pleased by the answer. "I was told," he later said, "it was $2 million. Daunting as it was, and it must have seemed impossible, if anyone was up to the job of keeping the company running, it was certainly Tommaso. For almost 2 decades, he had been the rock at the center of the empire, the one man who could be counted on completely to move the boss's merchandise, solve his problems, and guard his darkest secrets. As his nickname, El Licenciado, suggested, Tommaso was a different breed from the tough, unschooled culichis who typically surrounded Guzman. Born in El Dorado, a village south of Culiacan, he had been sent to law school by his father, a prominent local lawyer with connections to the PRI, and earned his first job in the state's public prosecutor's office through a recommendation from one of his professors. Tommaso later went to work for the Judicial State Police, serving, ironically, on an anti-violence task force, and eventually landed at Puente Grande Prison, where he met the inmate Guzman. When the kingpin broke out of Puente Grande, Tommaso was initially blamed for the escape. Embroiled in scandal and all but unemployable, he went to visit his one-time charge at one of his mountain lairs near Nayarit. A job was offered almost instantly. The disgraced former official was asked to join the company as a superintendent and real estate agent responsible for purchasing and managing the properties the kingpin used for business. While his early pay was modest, $1,500 a month, his potential for advancement was tremendous. Never lacking in ambition or intelligence, Tommaso was quickly promoted to dealing with the kingpin's Colombian suppliers and soon took control of his New York distribution routes. Within a few years, Guzman could barely make a deal or start a war without the former deputy warden at his side to give advice. "Tommaso was a scary guy," a member of the coalition said. "He was just so slick and smart. If there was anyone to watch out for, it was him, because you wouldn't see him coming." Though Tommaso was the obvious choice to run the kingpin's business, he himself was well aware that his promotion didn't sit well with the one group in the company it most affected, his boss's 4 sons. Long before the succession plan was put in place, the menores, or the young ones as everybody called them, had resented and distrusted their father's chief of staff. After years of watching the boys' callow antics, Tommaso distrusted them too. He had seen firsthand how Guzman's heirs, Iván, Alfredo, Ovidio, and Joaquín, were little more than spoiled sons of privilege, forever squandering their patrimony on cheap women, expensive sports cars, and exotic pets, interests that they documented obsessively on Instagram and Twitter. His own son, Tommaso López Serrano, had at first run in their little brat pack, the so-called Narco Juniors, and he had watched them all conducting business, signing their messages with smug millennial phrases, affirmative, bro, and texting recklessly on the company's communications system. Drugs. I need to work. The older boys, Ivan and Alfredo, at least brought something that resembled revenue into the company's coffers, working deals in Honduras and Los Angeles. Ovidio and Joaquin were hangers-on at best. They ran a few small meth labs in Culiacan, and every now and then moved cocaine across the Arizona border. Occasionally, the younger sons were brought in as partners on large joint shipments, but it was mostly as a tribute to their father. In the frantic days in 2014, when the Marines were preparing to stage their raid on Culiacan, Damaso had tried to have a talk with the boss about his boys. Ivan and Alfredo had just escaped arrest while eating out in a restaurant, slipping away only after some waiters had helpfully changed clothes with them and snuck them out the door. Damaso wrote to Guzman, boldly warning him that if the menores didn't strike a lower profile and keep away from the mouths of women and assholes, the company would suffer. The kingpin, while not quite disagreeing, seemed oddly tolerant of his prodigal sons. 11:34 p.m.
There is nothing else to do but deal with children because they are our blood. You have to be advising them, not scolding, because then it is worse.
Footnote. To their credit, many of the narco juniors did not come of age easily. Mayo Zambada's son, Serafin, testified at his sentencing hearing in San Diego in March 2018 that a car bomb had exploded outside his birthday party when he was 2 years old. 7 years later, he said, assassins stormed into a Mazatlan hotel room, killing his grandparents and his aunt and uncle. At his own sentencing hearing in 2019, Serafin's older brother, Vicente, said that a hit squad tried to murder him for the first time when he was only 16. Blood or no blood, the closer that the kingpin moved toward extradition, the harder it became to keep his empire and his family together. From the moment Guzman returned to prison, Ivan and Alfredo had been searching for a villain to blame. In a fit of filial vengeance, they had first turned their attention toward the officers who had taken him into custody, sending out their loyalists to track down and identify the men. But according to Damaso, the focus of their suspicions soon began to change. In the end, they fell on someone who was much closer to home, their father's longtime partner, Mayo Zambada. Not much had changed for Mayo himself after Guzman's arrest. With typical judiciousness, he had decided to play a waiting game and took the middle road between embracing and distancing himself from Guzman's sons. Mayo had always been exceptionally cautious. He often ate breakfast in one place, lunch in another, and took a siesta in a third. At 68, Mayo had been working as a trafficker for more than 50 years and had, in his seniority, achieved the respect and admiration of an elder statesman. While he generally thought of the menores as a nuisance, he knew that for the sake of peace within the company, they had to be endured. That spring, when Ivan and Alfredo asked for an audience at El Alamo, his baronial estate in a Spanish-style compound outside Culiacan, Mayo, a paragon of ceremony, granted their request. When the boys arrived and expressed their concerns about their father, the wise old trafficker told them not to worry. He reassured them that the arrangements he had reached with Guzman long ago still remained intact, and that the family would continue to receive its regular portion of his profits. Whether these promises were genuine or not, Ivan and Alfredo walked away from the encounter full of doubts. Within a few days, they went to see Damaso with an unthinkable proposal. They wanted to assassinate Zambada. Damaso claims that his first response was to ask the boys if they had spoken with their father and gotten his permission. When they admitted they had not, Damaso refused all further talk about the plot. It is impossible to say exactly when the company cracked open and splintered into separate warring factions, but by late in the spring of 2016, the fault lines were seething beneath the surface. Guzman's Federation had never been a cohesive organization. Even from its start, it had more resembled a medieval aristocracy than a chartered corporation, and was held together in good times by money and marital alliances, and was riven in bad times by brute displays of violence. But now, with its profits under threat and one of its top warlords on the sidelines, the center couldn't hold. Fiefdoms started forming, rebranding themselves as Los Chapitos. Guzman's sons claimed one corner of the kingdom and seized control of Culiacan. The kingpin's brother, Aureliano, claimed another piece from his base in Badiraguato near La Tuna. Damaso, marshaling an army, Damaso's special forces, took a third slice, centered in El Dorado. Behind El Alamo's stuccoed walls, Mayo Zambada was somewhere in the middle, committing himself to no one and maintaining ties to everyone. But with his talent for deception, it was hard to tell if he was playing the role of an umpire or a vulture. With its house divided, the company soon had enemies at its gates. Only weeks after Guzman's extradition was approved, a gang of as many as 150 gunmen descended on La Tuna. Entering the kingpin's village in a convoy of trucks and SUVs, the armed invaders moved past its modest shops and shacks and snaked up into the hills toward the pillared ochre mansion where Guzman's mother, who was nearly 90, lived. There, inconceivably, they broke into the house, sacking its rooms and severing its phone lines. Reports came down from the mountains that when neighbors tried to protect Maria Loera, they were killed. 2 months later, it happened again. This time, Alfredo, the kingpin's second son, was abducted at gunpoint at a bachelor party at La Leche, a white-walled seafood bistro near the beach in Puerto Vallarta. Several gunmen carrying assault rifles stormed into the dining room on a Monday night in August and forced the cartel scion and a half dozen others to their knees. They were spirited away, and it took nearly a week of backroom negotiations before they were released. The two attacks were far more than brazen and unprecedented signs of disrespect. They were watershed moments in the drug trade's geopolitics. Both of them were ultimately blamed on Alfredo Guzman Beltran, the son of Alfredo Beltran Leyva, who had, it seemed, waited patiently for more than 8 years to exact revenge on Guzman for his father's arrest. Even more troubling, the savvy upstart, who was one of the kingpin's nephews, had launched his assaults with the New Generation Jalisco Cartel, the company's erstwhile partner in its wars against the Zetas, which was already making inroads on Sinaloa's plazas in Tijuana and Baja California. Guzman had for years made his living by spotting and exploiting the weaknesses of his rivals. Now, in his own weak state, his rivals were doing it to him. But imprisoned in Juarez, he had no way of stopping the rebellion. The only tool at his disposal, the company's upper management, was paralyzed by rumor and division. And it wasn't even clear that the company's upper management still existed. As a lame duck king, there was little he could do but trust his lawyers and fight his extradition. But his lawyers weren't getting anywhere either. All of their appeals had been rejected, and some were quite creative. They had complained that he was freezing in his cell, that the charges against him had legally expired, and that his only human contact was with prison guards in ski masks. In a final failed attempt, they had even claimed that he would never get a fair trial in the United States. The environment up north, the lawyers said, was just too hostile toward Mexicans because of Donald Trump. By Christmas, the embassy was feeling optimistic. Only one court, the Fifth Collegiate Panel for Criminal Matters in the capital, had not yet considered Guzman's case. Nothing, of course, would happen until January 6th, when the holidays were over, but the embassy was hearing it would now be weeks, not months. Ambassador Jacobson and the rest of her team were not quite ready to celebrate, but they were getting close. They had made their decision. It was only after he was back in the United States, awaiting arraignment, the ambassador said, that we were going to get some good tequila and finally have a drink. It wasn't weeks, it was days. On January 19, 2017, the Fifth Collegiate Panel in Mexico City rejected the last appeal. That same evening, at about 5:30, Chapo Guzman was taken from his cell in Juarez and, smelling of the prison where he had been for months, was placed in handcuffs and put on a police jet. No one told him where he was going. Even his own lawyers didn't know he was on board. With him on the plane were three officials from the Mexican government and two American law enforcement agents. For more than 4 hours, as the plane veered east, then north, the Americans said nothing. No introductions, no light small talk, not a word. It was only when the plane began descending in the darkness toward an unfamiliar airport, MacArthur Airport on Long Island, that Guzman turned in confusion to his countrymen and asked where they were taking him. One of the Americans finally spoke to him in Spanish. "Welcome," he said, "to the United States." Epilogue. United States v. Guzman. The American criminal justice system isn't known for its vibrant sense of irony, but it came up with a good one on January 20th, 2017, just in time for Donald Trump's inauguration. On the same day, at practically the same hour, that much of the country watched the swearing-in of a man who had launched his political career by attacking bad hombres coming in from Mexico, Mexico's worst hombre, the drug lord Joaquin Guzman Loera, made his first appearance in federal court. Like most things in the drug war, it was impossible to know from the perspective of the moment if this coincidence of timing was coincidental or was instead a surreptitious effort to upstage Trump with a theatrical distraction. After all, if anyone could compete with the headline-hungry president for attention, it was Chapo Guzman. Like Trump himself, Chapo had been a single-name celebrity for decades. He, too, had earned a massive fortune during his career, and the kingpin's billions at least had the benefit of being verifiable. While both men had long been creatures of the media and styled themselves as simple, rough-hewn leaders, it was only after Trump's election that he acquired the concrete means of enforcing his will on life in the United States. Through endless acts of violence and corruption, Guzman, by that point, had been shaping events in Mexico for nearly 30 years. Certainly to those of us who spent Inauguration Day at the Brooklyn Federal Courthouse, the kingpin's arraignment in the early afternoon didn't feel like a second-rate assignment. With the kind of protection typically reserved for heads of state, Guzman had arrived that morning from his jail cell in Manhattan in a traffic-stopping convoy of a dozen government vehicles. First had come the police vans, with dome lights flashing, then an imposing row of unmarked SUVs. Only after the full parade had passed through a checkpoint near the court's garage had the prisoner himself appeared in an armored car followed by an ambulance. Waiting for him inside the courthouse, there was more. Federal agents with semi-automatics were stationed in the lobby. Bomb-sniffing dogs were on patrol in the hallways, and a two-man team of U.S. Marshals with little wands and backpack sensors were inspecting all the garbage cans for ambient radiation. As dozens of us packed into the courtroom, we were eager to see how the captured kingpin would react to all of this. Hours earlier, the Justice Department had issued a triumphant statement announcing the proceeding in which it had referred to Guzman as one of the principal leaders of the Sinaloa cartel, an accurate description that nonetheless left unsaid almost everything that mattered about the man. Whatever else he was, Chapo Guzman was no mere cartel boss. By almost any standard, he was one of the top 10 criminals in history. In the course of 30 years, he had smuggled nearly 1 million kilograms of drugs across the border, and that was just the fraction that the authorities had known about or seized. His wars of conquest and fits of vengeance had led to untold casualties in Mexico and helped to plunge his country into its bloodiest era since the Mexican Revolution. Throughout it all, he had remained an outlaw hero on a par with Al Capone and Jesse James, a folklore figure revered in songs and snuff films. Waiting for him to be hauled in from his holding cell, we expected someone worthy of the legend. Houdini, Zorro, and Escobar all rolled up in one. When he was finally brought in, he was nothing of the sort. A side door opened in the spacious room, and out walked a man in a pair of blue pajamas. Even prepared by his famous nickname, Shorty, we saw at once that Guzman was shrunken and diminished, a full foot smaller than the hulking guards who put him in front of the judge. With his sunken cheeks and jailhouse pallor, the kingpin looked confused, turning over his shoulder more than once to stare at the rows of faces staring back at him. He didn't look at all like a mythic criminal mastermind, blinking in the bright fluorescent lights. He looked like a man who made his living selling snack food on the subway. It started with a question. "Are you Mr. Guzman?" the judge inquired. "Sí, señor," he said. "Do you understand you have a right to an attorney?" "Sí, señor," he said. "Have you reviewed the charges you are facing?" "Sí, señor," he said. "Do you understand these charges?" "Well," the fabled drug lord answered, "I didn't until now." It was like that for months. Whenever he showed up in court, he was a cipher, silent, vacant, and drifting in what seemed to be a medicated daze. He rarely said a word, barely made a gesture, and betrayed no sign of his celebrated wiliness or fortitude. Sitting at a table in a foreign country, miles from his money and his empire, it appeared he had decided to simply get it over with and suffer through his fate. In the nearly 2 years that preceded his trial, his team of lawyers, first a pair of public defenders, then a trio of retained attorneys, had done what they could for him, which wasn't all that much. Starting at the end of the process, the lawyers attacked his extradition first. Officials in Mexico had initially consented to Guzman being tried along the border in either San Diego or El Paso, and the lawyers argued that by sending him to Brooklyn, they had broken their agreement. In a concurrent move that might have pleased their client, but had nothing to do with his multi-count indictment, they also complained about the kingpin's harsh conditions of confinement. From the moment Guzman arrived in New York, he was placed inside the one facility that was thought to be robust enough to hold him. 10 South, the dismal high-security wing of Manhattan's federal jail. In his solitary cell downtown, he was blasted by air conditioning and monitored by cameras. His lights stayed on all night, and his meals were passed to him through a slot in the door. On weekdays, he was given an hour of exercise on a treadmill and a stationary bike, but on Saturdays and Sundays, he was caged around the clock. His only human contact came from his jailers. Even his legal teams were forced to meet with him in separate rooms, divided by a plexiglass window. His letters were read, his phone calls were recorded, and the clock he purchased from the commissary was removed from him at one point without an explanation. With no view of the outside world, he could not tell time or distinguish day from night. After months of living in this limbo, Guzman began to suffer headaches and had difficulty breathing. He claimed he was having aural hallucinations, hearing music when there wasn't any there. Neither of these early issues was decided in his favor by the presiding judge in the case, Brian M. Cogan, a George W. Bush appointee, who ultimately turned down nearly every one of the defense's requests. Those grew to include a motion to limit evidence about the kingpin's prior jailbreaks and an effort to suppress the cell phone calls and flexi spy chats that the FBI and Christian Rodriguez had collected. As the trial date neared and their setbacks started mounting, Guzman's lawyers took a final tack and asked for a delay in the proceedings. They argued that the government had dragged its feet during discovery and had, as a tactical matter, buried them in thousands of pages of complicated documents. In all of their maneuverings, however, none of the lawyers went so far as to argue that the kingpin wasn't guilty. The problem was that everybody knew he was guilty. On certain days, if they were in the proper frame of mind, the lawyers would acknowledge it themselves. As the squabbling continued and the hearings dragged on, I made my own decision. I wasn't going to attend the trial itself. I had by that point been covering the courts for nearly 20 years, and after sitting through murder trials, mafia trials, terrorism trials, and police corruption trials, I was confident that Chapo Guzman's trial was going to be tedious at best. What else, I imagined, could still be said about a man who had lived in the spotlight since the early 1990s and had been picked apart by countless writers in countless books and news reports, not to mention a Netflix series, with a second on the way? From the outset of the case, the public filings had been filled with facts that we already knew from the biographies and magazines. Guzman had stashed his cocaine in cans of jalapenos and had once built a tunnel hidden beneath a pool table. In the first 10 months of the prosecution, there was only one new story, as far as I could tell, a local traffic story. Every time the kingpin's motorcade took him to court, crossing the river from Manhattan into Brooklyn, the police department, fearing an escape, closed the Brooklyn Bridge. In the end, however, the opportunity was just too big to miss, and feeling something like a hostile witness, I made my way to the Eastern District Courthouse at 6 a.m. on November 13, 2018, the first day of the trial. Even at that early hour, an unruly line of dozens of reporters from Bogota, Caracas, Culiacan, Washington, Los Angeles, Chicago, was queued up on the sidewalk, waiting to get in out of the freezing autumn dark. The federal building in Brooklyn Heights had seen its share of celebrity defendants, but the preparations and the appetite for this one were unprecedented. Quaint Cadman Plaza, once the province of family dogs and soccer moms, had been cut off from its neighborhood by what seemed like half the borough's squad cars and was under the watchful eye of an occupying army of body-armored riflemen. As I went inside the courthouse, I stepped on the elevator with a team of black-clad snipers. Long guns at their shoulders, they were headed upstairs to take up their positions on the roof. From the moment of its opening call, United States v. Guzman, the trial erupted like a geyser and didn't stop for months. Among the surprises that first day was one that was worth the wait. The kingpin was offering an actual defense. In his opening statement, Jeffrey Lichtman, Guzman's most vivacious lawyer, spun a tale of deep state conspiracy that seemed to have been plucked from an airport thriller novel. Chapo Guzman, Lichtman assured us, was not the real leader of the Sinaloa drug cartel, but was merely a convenient public scapegoat. The real leader was none other than his longtime partner, Mayo Zambada, who we were informed had orchestrated Guzman's arrest with a corrupt cabal of Mexican presidents and crooked American cops. The myth of El Chapo, Lichtman said. The prison breaks, the border tunnels, the cinematic scenes in the Sierras was precisely that, a myth. And the truth was disguised behind a veil of lies that obscured almost everything we knew about the drug war. Guzman hadn't broken out of prison years ago simply to be free. He had broken out to evade the hired assassins scheming to eliminate him. He hadn't fled to the mountains, hiding from the army or the CIA. He had fled to save his life. For more than two decades, Lichtman said, Guzman had either been in custody or on the run from the authorities, who had hunted him like an animal. Under such conditions, how could he have possibly built a multi-billion-dollar empire with hundreds of underlings on four different continents? The answer was he hadn't. Mayo Zambada had. The same Mayo Zambada, Lichtman reminded us, who had smuggled drugs for more than 4 decades, but never spent a single night in jail. In terms of pure intrigue, this was good material, not the least because even Lichtman's most implausible allegations were adjacent to the facts. Guzman really had been locked in prison, or running from the authorities for most of his career. Mayo Zambada really hadn't been arrested in all that time, despite the fact that many of his allies, enemies and children, had either wound up dead or in custody themselves. The Mexican government, it hardly needed saying, really was corrupt. By the end of that first week, the lackluster trial I had expected had turned into a kind of narco opera, something like what might have resulted if Wagner, García Márquez, and Elmore Leonard had all gone down to Tijuana to write the book and music with a case of Centenario. At the heart of the performance was the star-studded cast. Never before had prosecutors at a Mexican drug trial brought together so many witnesses from inside a cartel. Every other morning, another one of Guzman's friends or colleagues stepped onto the courtroom stage and mesmerized the audience with arias about the kingpin shipping cocaine in trucks of live sheep or jetting off to Switzerland for rejuvenation cures. The witnesses' own stories were equally remarkable, filled with accounts of cartel swag caps and of murders attempted with poisoned cornmeal pastries. It all began with Mayo's brother, Rey, who offered a masterclass in the organization's history and macroeconomics, and ended 12 weeks later with Memín Valdez, Guzman's former gunman, who spoke of locking his victims into cowsheds and searing them with clothing irons. In between, like the ghosts in A Christmas Carol, there were turns on the stand by Miguel Ángel Martínez, the kingpin's first employee, Juan Carlos Ramírez, his Colombian supplier, Pedro Flores, his American distributor, and a host of other by now familiar faces, Vicente Zambada, Damaso López, the two Cifuentes brothers, Christian Rodriguez, and the luckless mistress, Lucero Sánchez. Some of their testimony covered old ground. It had long been known that Guzman acquired his drugs from South and Central America in an ever-changing fleet of speedboats, submarines, and single-engine Cessnas, then moved it north across the border in tanker trains of cooking oil equipped with secret compartments and in crates of meat in the backs of 18-wheelers. It was also not a new revelation that over the years, his billion-dollar fortune had compromised almost every level of the government in Mexico, from mayors to generals, some said even presidents, and supported a payroll of pilots, drivers, accountants, gunsmiths, couriers, and lawyers, along with the lookouts posted throughout the country, who spied on his behalf. But what nobody had heard or seen before were the first-hand accounts of any of this, or the real human beings who had done these things themselves. Their presence in the courtroom breathed fresh life into the stale old tales and resulted in some new ones. From a narrative perspective, this was stunning. It was almost inconceivable that a man who had been probed and plumbed by journalists since 1993 had so much left to give. Halfway through the trial, something happened. After almost 2 years of aphasia, Guzman suddenly came to life. Until that point, the only discernible emotions he had showed were toward his wife. Emma Coronel was a fixture in the courtroom, showing up each day in the latest cartel fashions, usually accompanied by lawyers, publicity agents, and a heavy cloud of poison by Dior. On many mornings, as the guards brought Guzman into court, he would rise up on his tiptoes, find her in the crowd, and offer her a loving little wave. As he started to awaken, he seemed unable to resist trading similar gestures with the witnesses. When Alex Cifuentes took the stand, he glanced across the room at his old boss and gave a solemn nod that seemed like both a greeting and a kind of apology. Guzman nodded back as if to say, "It's fine, my friend. Relax. This is how it always had to end." The case, by then, was careening toward its preordained conviction. But even though the prosecution's evidence was overwhelming and the threat of life in prison was increasingly inevitable, Guzman was becoming more expansive. Now, each day, he was furiously scribbling on a legal pad and greeting his lawyers with cheerful hugs and handshakes every time he saw them. It could have simply been that, after 20 months in solitary confinement, he had once again found pleasure in community, even if the community he had found was largely there to watch his guilty verdict. It could, of course, have also been that with nothing left to lose, and with all eyes trained on him, he was starting to enjoy himself. None of us could really understand him. His world was a mad world, after all, a hallucinatory whirl of secret hideouts, mountaintop airstrips, diamond-studded pistols, teenage prostitutes, encrypted cell phones, rubber-banded money, and airplanes set on fire in the middle of the jungle. The central subjects of his trial, murder, drugs, corruption, were among the most serious that one could imagine, and yet they were presented in an atmosphere of unrelieved insanity. The more Guzman revealed himself, the more it was obvious that these two poles, absurdity and gravity, the idiot and the mastermind, were the basic architecture that formed his personality. There wasn't any separating one from the other. It could have been predicted that he would ultimately turn the trial into his own telenovela. On the day Lucero Sanchez appeared in court, she testified at length about her love affair with Guzman, then ran off the witness stand after bursting into tears. Emma Coronel was sitting only 30 feet away, pretending to feel nothing and casually pulling at the split ends of her hair. The following day, she and Guzman were back in court for the second half of his mistress's account, wearing outfits that Emma had picked out for them, identical burgundy velvet smoking jackets. The message, while ridiculously delivered, was as pitiless as a horse's head in a mobster's bed. Lucero, the other woman, was an insignificant felon dressed in prison clothes. Emma and her husband, the royal couple, were in red. And so it went, up until the final moment on February 12, 2019, when the jurors returned that day from their last deliberations. Guzman received their verdict, guilty on all counts, with the strangely muted look of a man who had been told that the brakes he had installed on his car last month would now need re-replacing. He had been far more demonstrative on any number of other days in court, including the one on which Alejandro Eda, the actor who portrayed him on Narcos Mexico, had come to see him on a reconnaissance mission. When Eda walked into the room that morning, one of Guzman's lawyers quietly leaned over to inform him that the man who played him on TV was in the gallery. His face lit up with a beatific grin. Though the trial had marked one of the most visible victories for U.S. law enforcement since the war on drugs had started in the early 1970s, it did almost nothing to halt the flow of illegal narcotics from pouring across the border. On January 31st, the same day closing arguments were held, border officials in Arizona made a startling announcement. They had just seized the largest load of fentanyl ever found in the United States. The haul, they said, had been hidden in a truck transporting cucumbers through the Nogales port of entry, a crossing that the Sinaloa drug cartel had run for years. Many of us held out hope for something more decisive at the kingpin sentencing that summer. When Guzman had come close, very close, to testifying in his own defense, he had eventually been dissuaded from the gambit by his lawyers, who no doubt noticed how eager the prosecution team had been to cross-examine him. By tradition, defendants are given the opportunity to address the court when they are sentenced, and Guzman's sentencing, which was slated for July, was going to be his last chance to address anyone ever again. It was a virtual certainty that after his penalty was handed down, he would be sent to the Supermax, the country's most secure federal prison in Florence, Colorado, where he would be locked in isolation for the remainder of his days. As his hearing approached, there was a quiet expectation that he might finally let loose, spilling all his secrets and naming various names. The day of the sentencing had an air of homecoming about it. Victor Vasquez came up to Brooklyn from his new assignment in Peru. Fern Cruz flew in from his own new posting in Atlanta. Marston and Potash, still in Lower Manhattan, got up early to be sure that Andrea Velez, who was planning to address the court herself, made it safely to and from the courthouse. Ray Donovan, now in charge of the DEA's office in New York, wanted to be there too. But something had come up with his wife. He had already given enough years of his life to Chapo Guzman and agreed to be with her when she asked him, for once, to let it go. After some preliminary business, Judge Kogan turned and looked down at the kingpin. "All right, Mr. Guzman," he began. "You have the right to be heard. Is there anything that you would like to say?" "Yes, Your Honor," Guzman answered. "Thank you very much." For the next 10 minutes, after blessing his wife, his family, and all of those who had kept him in their prayers, Guzman embarked on a diatribe about the deep unfairness of it all, complaining about his extradition, his 3-month trial, and his state of incarceration. He claimed that he was being tortured around the clock in his cell across the river, forced to drink unsanitary water, breathe old air, and block his ears with toilet paper to drown out the noises of the ventilation system. Arriving in this country, he explained, he had expected to receive a fair trial from a system he had hoped would be blind to his fame and reputation. But that hadn't happened. There had been no fairness, he insisted, and no real justice. His case was stained, and the entire world was watching. What had happened here, he said, had convinced him of an unassailable fact. The United States is not better than any other corrupt country that you do not respect. Certain human beings have the power to hold a gaze. Without even asking for it, they command our attention, the most valuable commodity we have. As petulant as all of this was, Guzman had been right about one thing. The world had been watching him, much like it had always watched him, millions of people across the planet, for nearly 30 years. The important questions: why had it been watching? Did he deserve it? And what was the point of all that concentration? Never seemed to have occurred to him. Perhaps he took it for granted. Or perhaps he understood what we did not, that no matter what he did and no matter what he said, no matter what happened, all of us were going to look at him. We hope you've enjoyed this production of El Jefe, a Macmillan Audio production for Flatiron Books. This title was produced by Guy Oldfield. This program was directed by Matt Cruz. Text copyright 2020, Alan Fuhrer. Production copyright 2020 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.